Out here, if you're doing nothing, you're doing everything right. Though on a cruise with Norwegian, even if you're doing nothing, you're still basking in the warm sun, enjoying the peaceful ocean waves, you're breathing. Don't forget about breathing. Definitely need to be breathing. So you get to do nothing or everything, but you still need to be breathing. It's like really important.
Experience the difference with cruises to Alaska, the Caribbean, and Europe. Norwegian Cruise Line. It's different out here. Visit NCL.com, call your travel advisor, or 1-888-NCL-CRUISE. Norwegian Cruise Line ships registry, the Bahamas and USA.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. Ladies and gentlemen, girls and boys and whatever, I'm delighted to welcome onto the show author of Serial Survivor, which is a brilliant name for a book. A man who, in my book, and I haven't written one yet, needs no introduction. It's Derek Daly. Derek, good morning to you, sir.
Hey, good morning. You're in Marbella. Wow, I am jealous.
Well, come on. You're an F1, an ex-F1 pilot. You're probably sitting on a rooftop terrace in Monte Carlo, you know, sipping a martini, you know, several sort of pit girls, because the grid girls had to go somewhere. The pit babes had to go somewhere when they got kicked off. So they're probably all at the back. You know, you're probably trying to get Eddie Irvine off them, but you know what I mean? They're probably somewhere lurking in your apartment. Where are you, Derek?
Well, that's the plan for later. Right now, I'm in Brooklyn's hotel. It is grey. It's rainy. I've been in England for the last week. I've been in Ireland for a week before that, all on this book tour for Serial Survivor. So the plan is to live like you as soon as I can.
That is going to be on my tombstone, I think. But there you go. For petrol heads like myself, you are, you know, you started off in Ireland. You do some of the great circuits like Mondello Park. It was F3, F2, all the way up into F1. But a lot of people won't know the move that you've made over to the States, which was quite a rare thing in those days for a European driver. And subsequently, your move, you know, you won some of the greatest races. Sebring, for example, you drove the mighty Nissan Group C car, blimey O'Reilly, and then you forged a path as a commentator. So that's if you like a brief resume, and I told you I was a fanboy. But where did it all start, Derek? Because I mean, motor racing in Ireland in the 60s was not, but pretty much a thing. It was just about Mondello Park, and that was it.
Well, it wasn't even that until 1968. So when I saw my first race, it was in Dunboyne, a small village on the outskirts of Dublin City. Now, remember, the racetrack around the village, it went by a grocery store, a Catholic church, and 7 or 8 pubs. That's how you followed where the cars were going to go. A very basic introduction. My dad took me to a race, changed my life. I told him right there and then, I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
Somehow I'm going to be a racing driver. And to do it from Ireland when you didn't even have a racing circuit, it was a bit audacious. But The book Serial Survivor, it's interesting. That name grew organically through all the issues that were captured in the different chapters. But I have had the most amazing life and experiences all through happening to see a race in the village in Dunboyne when I was 12 years of age. It has been an unbelievable journey, and it may not even be over yet.
Well, I would hope not. I mean, at least until 11 o'clock, because otherwise it's going to be this interview will drop off for either very, very suddenly indeed. But I mean, every small boy, I mean, hey, you know, like I wanted to be a racing driver and I had more advantages to get into the sport than anybody else, you'd say. However, for a small boy, you know, in Ireland, your dad wasn't a racing family. Was there an interest in cars from back in the day?
No, nothing. My dad had a local grocery store, sold vegetables to the neighbors. That was it. But he was always supportive of everything I wanted to do. But I was sort of hardwired to be a risk taker. It was baked into me from an early age. And I didn't know it at the time. But when you're hardwired to be a risk taker, you get yourself in a lot of trouble at times. But the absolute key for me is to always focus forward. My mother always told me, whatever's bad could always be worse. And so that was her mantra she got from her mother. And I took it also and lived by that mantra because, you know, you were here for such a short time. you have to make the best of it. And why not take a chance or a risk and chase a dream that some people might think is unattainable? For me, it was at least, I never told people, look, I'm going to be a Formula One driver. But what I did tell people is I will do everything in my power to allow me to go as far as I can possibly go. And it happened to be Formula One and then IndyCar racing in America after that.
But how do you do the first steps? I mean, how do you, because I said every kid wants to be a racing driver. They go to a race and they say, that's it, I'm going to be the next, you know, I'm going to be the next Nigel Mansell, I'm going to be the next Lewis Hamilton, I'm going to be the next, you know, Lando Norris. And that's all great. And apart from, you know, playing on your PlayStation or whatever, I mean, that's as far as it goes. So how do you go from your dad having a grocery store? No, you know, it's road circuits in Ireland, you know, all the TTs and all that. So how do you go from that stage to actually getting a car? And then, you know, where's the first race? Presumably it's over the water, or how does it happen?
So in the early 70s, needed a chunk of money to buy a Formula Ford. Formula Ford was the basic starting ground that everybody came through. It was all over the globe. And so myself and a friend of mine, David Kennedy, who lived just 2 or 3 miles from me, we were in a car park one time and said, how are we going to make a chunk of money? There was two options. We could become laborers in the Alaskan oil pipeline that was just starting to, the project was just starting at the time, or we could go to Australia and be laborers in the iron ore mines of Australia. Now, to go to Alaska, they charge you £1,000 for clothing to keep you warm so as you didn't die in the climate.
Right.
In Australia, they gave you scissors, you cut the legs off your trousers and the sleeves off your shirt and you were well-dressed. That was us. We were there and we literally, 2 weeks after we heard about the opportunity in Australia, signing on to be flown to the single men's quarters in Cliffs Robe River of Northwest Australia, and 6 months in a labor camp to earn enough money to come back and buy a Formula Ford.
Good grief. So two things. A, you've known David Kennedy that long, because again, very well known. I mean, again, petrol head here, but great driver as well. So you two go back that far. And B, I mean, David Kennedy, if I remember correctly, is got what, you know, paler skin than my glass of milk in the morning. How on earth did he survive in Australia?
yeah, with great difficulty and in the shade. But here's the thing. Australia was, I mean, we mixed with criminals, convicts, you know, we were pretty naive boys from Dublin there on a mission. But I mean, we were mixing with people who wouldn't think twice of settling an argument with a knife or a gun. But we were there to try and do as many hours as possible. So in Australia, the first 8 hours, you got paid straight time. If you could work a second 8 hours in a row, you got double time. If you could work 24 hours straight, you got triple time. That was our mission. How many triple time shifts could we do, 24-hour shifts? You wouldn't even be allowed to work that hard these days. But for us, you know, the cash began to grow and we started living our dream as soon as we got back.
So you got back. Presumably you're as fit as a butcher's dog at that point then, because you've been doing all these shifts in Australia. So you go back to the UK and flip through the back section of a copy of All Those Sports. I mean, how do you find that? So presumably it's a 1600, the, you know, Formula Ford 1600 you're starting with. So how do you make sure you haven't got a duff one? And do you both sort of like take this bond of brothers and we're both going to do this together? Do you get one car? Do you get two cars? I mean, how does it pan out, Derek? This is fascinating.
Yeah, we ended up getting two cars, raced in Ireland for 1975. I won the championship. David said we have to go to England. That's the you have to become legitimate. You have to win in England. You have to go there. That's the home of professional racing. Off we went. He bought an old bus. I bought an old bus. Took all the seats out of it. My mother made the curtains. My sister made the mattress. I put a toolbox in, went off to race in England like a gypsy. Track to track, we earned £59 if you won a Formula Ford race. It was enough to buy diesel to get you to the next racing circuit.
Yeah, but the thing is, I mean, that formula, I mean, it's the cutting ground. I mean, it's the breeding ground of champions, but it also smashes a lot of drivers' hopes because it is intensely competitive because it's low budget. The cars are relatively easy to set up, the tyres, etc. But everybody's having a crack at it. You know, everybody wants to be a racing driver. So if you like, the kill rate or the cutoff rate is, you know, you get the, you know, the Formula Ford Festival at Brands Hatch, and that really is a proving ground. So what's it like coming up against British talent / European talent at this point? Who are you coming up against? Is it sort of, you know, Brundle, Blundell, all that? Like, who are you seeing over there then?
A little bit earlier, the best driver in Formula Four that year was Derek Warwick.
Whoa, okay.
But his guy made it all the way to Formula One, so yeah. We knew it was going to be brutal. We knew we were going to learn from the fastest guys over there, and we were there for the challenge. And you mentioned the Formula Ford Festival. At the end of 1976, James Hunt had just won the World Championship. Marlboro sponsored that year's Formula Ford Festival. It's called Tribute to James. I went there, won everything. The heat, the final, the semi-final, the quarter-final, the final, and got the trophy from James Hunt. It was, mind you, it was piss and rain the whole weekend, so perfect Irish weather.
Exactly.
To slap around in. But that was a major step up for me, because when James Hunt gives you a trophy, you're all over the media, you're high profile, and that allowed me to step up into Formula 3, and then the rocket ship really took off.
What did the old, you know, as Will Conning called the old farts, think about these two Irish guys coming over? Because Kennedy's doing good, you know, David Kennedy's doing great things as well. Did they think, who are these people from across the water? They shouldn't be. We've got young people who've been racing at Goodwood and Snetterton and, you know, et cetera.
Yeah, probably did say that. Didn't matter to us. David won both championships, RAC and Townsend Harrison.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we pretty much dominated Formula Ford. But motor racing, there was no political barriers at the time, which was good. Everybody was supportive. It was a great time, because I don't know whether you remember it well, and you wouldn't be old enough, but 1976 was a great heat wave.
I was eight. Okay, but I remember it very well, Derek. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a great summer, no rain, heat every day. There was a minister for drought in England. You were told to flush the water, you wash the dishes in down the toilet, you know. And we were gypsies just going racetrack to racetrack. So it was a perfect time. I mean, I documented as much as I could in the book, but some of the stuff that happened to us, accidents and all sorts of things, but you just had to keep going. You were living your dream, and you couldn't give up on it just because something bad happened.
So you go from, you know, Formula Ford 1600 to F3. That's a huge leap, because you've gone from open wheel racing, if you like, no downforce, no wings, etc. And it is a quantum leap between Formula 1600 and Formula 3. And people's racecraft can fall away. But again, how did you find it? And did you think, okay, it's got a wheel in each corner, I'll go for it?
Yeah, so Formula 3 is the stepping stone to European racing. It's the level where Formula 1 team managers begin to take notice.
Yeah.
If you can win a lot of races, they'll at least say, maybe something there we're interested in. I go to the British Grand Prix, big event, huge. You're in front of the F1 team managers. I get into a huge tussle with Stephen South from England, fastest guy in Formula 3 that year. I could get a better start. I could potentially give him a headache trying to take the lead. And we got into a big tussle. We touched wheels. He flipped upside down, ended up in Stoke Mandeville Hospital, came back to the track and said, Daly tried to kill me. I was so close. I went to my mentor, my sponsor, Derek McMahon, a big fella from Donegal. I said, look, I'm always in tears. We have to go to the Austrian Grand Prix support race, F3. I can win these races. We go to Austria, qualify on the pole, get into a barnstormer with Nelson Piquet, win the race. And right before the race, an old guy with a limp and a shuffle walked up across the front of my car as I'm on the pre-grid, told my sponsor, Derek McMahon, if he wins this race today, I'll put him in a Formula One car by the end of the year. It was a fella called Sidney Taylor, who raced in Dunboyne when I was 12 years of age and went to see, got my first impression of racing. How can you complete that circle?
And this is the old Österreichring, isn't it? Fearsomely quick.
Yes.
How did you feel like that? Because, I mean, how old are you at that point? You're like, what, 20?
No, that was 77, so I was 24 at the time.
Scary, though, still, that Österreichring. I mean, just absolutely ridiculous.
But true to his word, I won the race and I was in a Formula One car testing at Goodwood 3 months later, which means I went from Formula Ford, where James Hunt gave me the trophy, to Formula One in 13 months. It's still the fastest rise to Formula One today. Yeah. Mad stuff.
Mad stuff indeed. So who was your first F1 team then? Who actually signed you, and how do you, you know, and what does Kennedy think of this, by the way? If because it is he get into four, you get into Formula One before, you know, before he even gets a chance to get up there.
So first Formula One team I tested for was Theodore Racing. Yep. A Chinese finance team by Teddy Yip. The test went well, offered me a contract. I couldn't get a super license. Can you imagine I had to turn down a Formula One contract offer?
Ouch.
So I went back to Formula Two, the Formula Two championship, won the fifth race and the sixth race of the championship, got another call from F1, Team Ensign. We're looking to replace Jackie Ickx. We'd like to try a brave young guy. Do you want to have a go?
This is Mo Nunn, isn't it? Brilliant, yeah. Mo. And what was it like getting, we're going to get rid of Jackie Ickx and we're going to bring in Derek Day. What do you think at that point? Do you think, oh, blimey, we talk about boots to follow.
Yeah. I mean, at that time, life was a blur. Things were happening so fast. I mean, I was hanging on. And you just react. You don't have time to plan. You just react and you jump in and you do the best you can. And so the British Grand Prix, Brands Hatch, 1978 was my Grand Prix debut. And ironically, I qualified 15th, 800ths of a second slower than James Hunt, who was 14th right beside me, just under the podium where he gave me the Formula Ford trophy less than 2 years earlier.
Can I ask you this question, okay?
Yeah.
When you get into a racing car for your first F1 race and you pull onto the grid and you look around, did you have a moment of, you know, sweet, what's it in all the little angels, I'm here? Or are you absolutely dialed in? Because, I mean, I would look across and see James Hunt, you know, and presumably this is, what, 77? So it's Brands or it's Silver? Oh, it'll be Brands, aren't you?
And Brands Hatch,
and
yeah.
You're going, you know, I've got to do Paddock Hill Bend in the middle of an F1 pack. I shouldn't really be here. Please, whoever's looking after me, make sure I can at least get up the hill to Druids.
It was, I'd be telling you lies if I didn't tell you. It was an emotional moment.
Yeah.
I had chills. You fight back the tears. Remember, I'm just a shy boy from Dublin, and suddenly I'm in the British Grand Prix where I, you know, watch stars in the past, and I never really truly thought you could get there, because Formula One drivers were always, they seemed to be on a different platform.
Yeah.
They were stars. But remember, I promised myself I'd go as far as I could. I'd do everything I could. And it happened to be Formula One. But it's a surreal time to look at James Hunt, to see Ronnie Peterson, yeah, Mario Andretti, Niki Lauda. We're all in the same driver's meeting together. And you know, I pinched myself. And you wonder, you know, this is the wow factor, you know, on steroids.
Yeah. And for the next season, what was it, 78? Who are you with in 78 then for that season?
But 78 was Ensign. Then yeah. 79, I left Ensign halfway through and moved over to Team Tyrrell, Ken Tyrrell.
Yeah. And you get Ken, you get Uncle Ken, don't you? And this is, you know, this is, one could argue this is like the last competitive, you know, relatively decent car that Tyrrell put out from their heyday in sort of 73. What was it like, yeah, sort of dealing with a legend again? Because you're dealing with bona fide legends at this point.
So when you sign for Tyrrell, you get access to Jackie Stewart. So the first thing I did was go to Jackie Stewart's house in Geneva, sit down, have a chat. And, you know, he says, you know, I'll make myself available for whatever you need. So, you know, you see him, you see the words and you hear them coming out of his mouth and you see his lips moving,
yeah,
but you can hardly believe he's actually talking to me. This is Jackie Stewart, 3 times world champion. I'm in his house. There's a swimming pool. There's Lake Geneva.
Yeah.
You know, this is just mad
stuff.
Here's
Helen bringing in the tea and you're trying not to gulp too much.
Exactly. Yeah. But I did tell him I met James Hunt.
that must have gone down really well, because obviously Jackie, yeah, not, if you're looking at two opposites of the way you approach racing, yeah, I think Jackie and James, yeah, were absolutely there.
You know, life is on fire. My hair is on fire. It's just the wildest time to live through.
What was the Tyrrell like to drive? Because, I mean, people who don't know you and don't know what you've done, should we get the 300-pound cartwheeling elephant out of the room? Because there are two things. One is the one that is at Monaco, is 1980, isn't it, when you land on, unfortunately, at, yeah, Sandoval, you get it wrong. And I've only ever seen this as a still photograph, but my goodness, you walked away from that huge crash at Zandvoort at the end of Tarzan. And, you know, if you ever want to see a car, you know, it's like a bird's eye view of a car, except the camera is on the ground and you are the guy doing the bird's eye view. And then the car failures, interesting experience, to put it mildly.
Yeah, that was the first time in my career that things began to go wrong.
Yeah.
I had too many mechanical failures. Mm. I got afraid to drive the car. I mean, when you have a 190 mile an hour crash into a guardrail,
yeah,
and you think you're going to die, that affects you. It definitely affects you. And so that was the first time in my career that things began to go sideways, as opposed to staying on the rocket ship.
Yeah, indeed. And were you at Monza in 78 for Peterson's crash? Were you there?
I was one of five drivers who gathered around Ronnie Peterson, trying to pull him from his car, on fire, searing heat, looked like an airplane accident. James Hunt actually undid his belt, threw him out on the ground right in front of my feet. I could see his legs were so severely damaged, he was like a rag doll. But he lifted his arm and he opened up his visor. So I said, good, he's alive. That's good. That's all we need. An hour later, the race restarted. I was in tears as I tried to recall to some British journalists what I'd just seen. And while I'm still trying to be consoled by my family, I got a tap on my shoulder. Derek, the race is about to restart. The spare car is ready. Pull yourself together. And so you had to forget what you just saw, their horrific experience, get back into the car and go and perform. And I actually had my first top 10 in Formula One that afternoon. So it just, you know, you're forced into a mindset that you have no training for. But that's part of why F1 is so difficult and so great.
As I always say, on the back of every entrance to a circuit, it's got motor racing is dangerous, and it's not there for a bit of added thrill. It's an absolute certainty. But you survive those crashes. You survive your crashes. Of course, Ronnie unfortunately dies later. Awful loss. Let's move on, though. 81, 82, you're in Williams. You know, Keke Rosberg's is going to win the championship in that year. Again, you know, tragic circumstances as well. You lose Pironi to a crash and obviously Gilles. But you think that Rosberg wins the car. The Williams is a good car. They've won championships in Alan Jones the year before. Exactly. Regazzoni's won races. You think there were some problems with your car technically, don't you? And you look at that in the book.
Well, I came into Williams in unusual circumstances. I was a fill-in bit player because Carlos Reutemann was their choice and he decided to retire.
Yeah.
And when I went there, the focus was on Keke. I understood that. Mm. But I didn't realize I was at such a disadvantage because of the car that I was given.
Yeah.
Like, for example, at Brands Hatch, I'm not being arrogant, but nobody was faster than me around Brands Hatch, especially Keke Rosberg. I had dominated in Formula Ford, Formula 3, a stellar F1 debut, and I was 1.4 seconds slower than him in practice, in qualifying. Now, if Frank believed I was 1.4 seconds slower, he should have fired me right there and then. He fired Damon Hill when he was world champion, Nigel Mansell when he was world champion, so he should have fired me unless he knew why I was slow. Mm. Now, in race laps, direct head-to-head for the full length of the race, I was faster time and time again. And if I was slower, it was by a tenth. So I never knew this until I wrote the book. I wrote the book and I pulled out all the details, all the facts, all the figures, all the lap times, and it became so obvious. So my career was sabotaged by my move to Williams. Formula One pushed me out. I got divorced at the time because I was in a spiral.
Right.
But that led me to America. A whole new world opened up in America.
Because people didn't go to America that. I mean, okay, Mike, because when Mansell went over in 93, it was like, oh, he's going to America. But it didn't happen. I mean, okay, you had Jim Clark, Graham Hill, they go over, you know, Jackie was going to the Can-Am races in the 70s. But nobody doing like IndyCar. And IndyCar at this point is wonderful. But I've got to ask you this question, Derek. Ovals. I mean, how do you get your head around an oval?
Exactly. Now, remember, in my day, Formula One drivers went to Indy, raced, and left.
Yeah.
I went to Indy, raced, and stayed.
Yeah.
I only went there for curiosity in 1983, and I never left. I still have a home in Indianapolis. It was an unbelievable world. The oval tracks, the high-speed oval tracks, were something like I'd never experienced. European drivers don't understand – the challenge of oval track racing. But the problem was, it came with great danger. When something happened, your feet and legs were first at the scene of the accident.
Yeah.
And that was the danger element. And unfortunately, the speeds we were running, if something went wrong, it could be catastrophic. And it was for me in 1984.
Huge crash, isn't it? Is it somebody else's oil, is it not? Something like that, and you just go straight into the, you know, into the wall.
It actually just began to rain. And so oval tracks, as soon as there's a mist of rain, the yellow flag, they can't run at those speeds.
Sure.
And they were just about 10 seconds too late. As soon as I crashed, it rained, the race was cancelled, ran it the next day, but I was already in intensive care.
Thankfully, you come back from that, because I've only got 4 minutes left, but... Okay. Just tell me about the Nissan Group C cars and you know, endurance driving, because, again, different challenge, different mindset.
Yeah.
But, again, monster cars.
Yeah. So after the monster crash, I could have given up. That was the easy thing.
Yeah.
But I didn't want. I didn't want the accident to be the legacy. So I got back to full-time racing, got back to IndyCar, got an opportunity to drive for Jaguar first at Le Mans, went back to America and got signed with a Nissan GTP program. The best team in America, the best racing car I've ever driven, and I got to finish off my career the last 2 years in sports car racing. But at that time, I'd already started a career in television broadcasting.
Yeah.
So by the time I wanted to finish racing, I was already established in television broadcasting, and that was a whole new world of color and glamour that I would never have imagined. Paul Newman, Sylvester Stallone, Muhammad Ali, David Letterman. I mean, these all became fast friends, and it was just unbelievable.
And Mario Andretti, one of the greats of all time. You know, people go, oh, yeah, but, I mean, Andretti's backstory, he's just won everything, and, you know, he's a friend. I mean, to call Andretti a friend is a
very good friend of mine. I wrote a book about the skills needed to be a successful professional racing driver. I was honored to have Mario write the foreword for my book. We're good friends. We've done lots of events together. And he allowed me, as you can imagine, to continue to live my dream.
What's it just, I mean, because very few drivers can actually talk about, you know, what racing is like in terms of describing to people rather than going, he's overtaken. James was great. Jackie Stewart's very, very good. Sterling was kind of okay as well. Martin, you know, mine does the famous, you know, the walkabout. How did you, because is it just an Irish thing? Were you able to talk a lot? You know, did you think that was, you know...
I think it has to be a gift of the gab of the Irish, because I had no formal training. But when they told me paint the picture, I understood that immediately. And so I had that ability to listen to the producer, talk about what you're seeing on the screen, think ahead to what might be coming up and ask the producer for certain things. And I just had a natural ability to multitask like that. And I loved to do it. I had a passion for it. And after I won the Sebring 12-hour race, getting back to the winning podium after my accident, people think, well, that's really good. But when I got back to the podium, I knew it was the beginning of the end of my driving career, because the buzz of success wasn't what I thought it was. So after the biggest win of my career, I knew I'm ready to move away. I'm ready to walk into the next career, which is television broadcasting.
It's all covered. I could talk to you about this today it's Wednesday. I could talk to you about this about until Friday. What I think you should do, Dave, is come over to Marbella. We'll continue this conversation very, very soon.
I think we should do this again.
Absolutely. Yeah. The book is called Serial Survivor. It's by the great Derek Daly. Derek, listeners, go forth onto the website and order it now, okay? If people want to find you online, where's the best place to find out what Derek's up to?
DerekDaly.com, DerekDaly.com.
You know, they say you should never speak to sort of people that you've sort of grown up with, sort of fantasizing. Oh, you know, wanted to be listen, can I just say, Derek, this has been one of the best motor racing interviews I've done, and I've done quite a few, but it's been absolutely brilliant to speak to you. The book is called Derek Daly, Serious Survivor. Go buy it, find out what happened in chapter 2. I think we're going to have to get you back on to talk about how you sort of forgot to put the microphone on with Michael Schumacher. Do you fancy coming back on the show, Derek?
Yeah. Call me anytime. Brilliant. Ready to go.
Brilliant. The book is called Serial Survivor. It's by Derek Daly. Derek, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Giles. Thank you, Steph.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more.
That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.